Today, watch for the signs. The DFA Daily for the 22nd of January, 2020. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest posts covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Well, there's a lot going on, and I want to start today with the price movements on Bitcoin and other cryptos. And indeed, as Bloomberg wrote, prices are nearing a three-week low. And the question is, what is going on? Bitcoin tumbled by as much as 11.3% on Thursday, sliding below $31,000. The largest digital asset has trended lower ever since breaking through the $40,000, and losses have accelerated in the past 2 days. While soaring crypto prices fueled a speculative mania among the Robin Hood crowd, it's also made professional investors reluctant to buy at the top, and prices are still more than double the levels from early November. And some technical analysts have argued that a retracement is overdue. It last traded below $30,000 on January the 4th. Bitcoin has already achieved the fastest ever price appreciation of any must-have asset, wrote JP Morgan Chase & Co. strategists John Norman and Federico Mandacari in a report on Thursday. Current prices are so far above production costs that mean reversion lower in the returns is a recurring concern. Adding to the anxiety, a report in a trade blog suggested that there had been what's known as double purchase, where the same coin is used in two separate transactions, but industry veterans downplayed that notion. This, they said, is part of the normal operation of the blockchain to allow for a highly parallel system. Occasionally, the Bitcoin blockchain will have competing mined blocks, but only one chain forming from competing blocks will be accepted by the network. However, should a double spending event actually occur, it would be a cause for concern in the market, according to Edward Moyer, senior analyst at Onda. Chart patterns suggest the market is consolidating within a bullish pennant formation, according to Matthew Weller, who's the head of research at Gain Capital Growth. A sharp move higher could push prices above $50,000, while a break lower would point to a deeper retracement below $30,000. He predicted, well, that's got all bases covered then, hasn't it? It would likely take a more severe drop to erase the established uptrend, Weller wrote in a note. Despite the sell-off, Wall Street hasn't lost interest in the new asset class. On Wednesday, BlackRock filed paperwork to add Bitcoin futures as an eligible investment in two funds, the first time the money manager is offering clients exposure to cryptocurrency. But then, of course, Bitcoin plunged more than 10% on Thursday, sparking a hunt for reasons the notoriously volatile asset was selling off, and one that captured attention to question the very viability of the token itself, though it turned out not to be a great cause for concern. A report in a trading blog had suggested that there could be what's known as a double spend, where the same token is used by the same person in two transactions. It's like if someone bought a car, paid the seller, drove off with their brand new wheels, and then later yanked back all the money. In the case of blockchain, or the software that underlies Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, the transaction in question will be excluded from the final tally in a digital ledger. But in this case, It doesn't look like a merchant was defrauded, said Nick Carter, the co-founder of Coinmetrics, which is a data firm. This doesn't look sinister to me. My best guess is this is experimentation or a software bug. Bitcoin was created with the intention of being a digital currency that doesn't require any centralized authority to back it or to oversee transactions. Instead of bank software handling electronic transfers, Bitcoin is transacted on a blockchain, basically a spreadsheet that logs when coins move and to where. Transactions are entered on the blockchain after an unaffiliated third party verifies the deal, often in exchange for partial coins. The blockchain is supposed to be immutable, helping to prevent fraud and making transactions irreversible. A double spend would effectively mean the blockchain had been manipulated, which would negate Bitcoin's heralded security claim. Merchants often wait for a payment to be verified as many as six times. In the case of the reported double spend, the transfer was apparently verified only once and then entered on the ledger and then was revoked. Now, it's rare to consider a payment final after only one confirmation, said Carter. What likely happened is that two blocks, the crypto term for verification, had the same transaction from the same address, but that one block was ultimately excluded. But still, online discussions over potential blockchain implementations intensified with Google searches for Bitcoin double spend spiking. Bitcoin, of course, fell as much as 11% on Thursday to trade around $31,000. Other cryptocurrencies also were sold off, with the Bloomberg Galaxy Crypto Index losing as much as 10%. The Bitcoin blockchain is operating exactly as designed and has been operating exactly as designed for 12 years, said Andreas Antonopoulos, an expert in Bitcoin and open blockchain technologies. What we saw today was a one-block reorganization. These occurs on average every 2 weeks and are a normal part of the consensus algorithm. Perhaps a more realistic reason for the drop in the value of cryptos was Yellen's suggestions that lawmakers should curtail the use of cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin, saying she is concerned that they are mainly used for illegal activities. The comments from Yellen suggest the incoming administration of Joe Biden could be hostile to cryptocurrencies, an attempt to ramp up regulation. Watchdogs around the world, from the European Central Bank to the UK's financial regulator, have also recently expressed concern over cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. Senator Maggie Hassan asked Yellen about the dangers of terrorists using cryptocurrencies during the recent Treasury confirmation hearing. Yellen said, "You're absolutely right that the technologies to accomplish this change over time, and we need to make sure that our methods for dealing with these matters with terrorist financing changing along with changing technologies. Cryptocurrencies are a particular concern. I think many are used, at least in a transaction sense, mainly for illicit financing. And I think we will need to examine ways in which we can curtail their use and make sure that money laundering doesn't occur through these channels." Yellen's comments echoed those of ECB President Christine Lagarde, who last week said Bitcoin had been used for some totally reprehensible money laundering activity. And major investors also have worries. Warren Buffett said last year that Bitcoin has been used to move around a fair amount of money illegally. He said investors should go short suitcases, as criminals will no longer need them to carry cash. Advocates say the lack of central control makes them attractive in other ways. For example, they argue Bitcoin can serve as protection against the debasement of national currencies when central banks launch huge stimulus programs. But of course, the truth is that there is a contention between central bank digital currencies, which are controlled and more centralized digital currencies, and the decentralized world of Bitcoin and Ethereum and the 4,000 other coins. And this is a tussle which has a long way to play out, and I think is explaining the volatility that we see currently in the prices. And it's too soon, in my mind, to make a call as to which way this is going to play out. And meanwhile, over in the US, Janet Yellen has left the door open to tax increases on wealthy Americans. Treasury Secretary-designate Janet Yellen said she would work with lawmakers to fast-track a series of tax increases on corporations and wealthy Americans as the Biden administration tries to pass spending on infrastructure and expanding the social safety net. Yellen, who awaits Senate approval for the post on Thursday, submitted written responses to Senate Finance Committee members following up questions on topics spanning climate change to sanctions policy. The Senate Finance Panel is scheduled to advance Yellen's nomination on Friday, although a full Senate confirmation vote might not happen until next week. But there are some interesting highlights in Yellen's comments. For example, on tax policy, Yellen promised to work with members of Congress on whether households earning less than $400,000 a year would be protected from any reversal of President Donald Trump's 2017 tax cuts, something Biden pledged on the campaign trail. She also dodged the question of whether a repeal of the cap on state and local tax deductions, as proposed by Biden, would deliver a big tax cut to wealthy Americans while doing next to nothing for those in the bottom half of the income distribution. She was more direct in responding to criticism on Biden's plan to reduce the threshold for the federal estate tax, saying about the wealthiest 6 out of every 1,000 estates would face any tax under the plan. Yellen rebuffed criticism from Republicans that raising the corporate rate to 28% from 21% as Biden promised would make the US less competitive. The money could be used to invest in infrastructure and offer programs that would boost Americans' businesses, she said. And Yellen suggested the wealthy could be audited at higher rates under her tenure. More robust IRS enforcement is one way to sidestep Congress in bringing in more revenue. Now, with regard to the Fed-Treasury ties, Yellen suggested that she wouldn't mount a fresh fight to revive several Federal Reserve lending facilities that were phased out by her predecessor. The Federal Reserve will continue to provide support to the economy through its ongoing programs and the use of its available tools, but as mandated by Congress, the 13-3 facilities funded by the CARES Act will not be available, she wrote, referring to a section of the law governing the Fed. At the same time, she said, right now, taking too little action poses the greatest risk. She also pledged not to pressure the Fed on the scope of its asset purchases, a point of concern among some politicians and economists, given the scale and impact of Fed bond buying. I understand deeply why it is so important to maintain the tradition of the independence of the Fed in monetary policy, said the former Fed chief. With regard to exchange rates, Yellen reiterated her pledge from Tuesday that the US won't seek a weaker currency, and didn't refer to the strong dollar policy the Treasury once pursued. Asked about concerns surrounding the dollar's role as the key global reserve currency, she said this status is supported by the US having the largest economy and the deepest and most liquid capital markets. We are committed to maintaining a sound economy and confidence in our financial system, she said. Yellen said the administration will work across agencies to put effective pressure on countries that are intervening in the foreign exchange market to gain a trade advantage. And she singled out bilateral deficits as an indicator of unfair trade practices, which she said she will vigorously oppose. Although she said the gaps should be assessed in the context of the US's broader trade relationship with each country, rather than a single catch-all metric. With regard to China, Yellen reiterated that there will be no immediate lifting of tariffs on China, and that Biden's administration will be monitoring China's adherence to pledges made in the Trump administration's Phase 1 bilateral trade deal. And she also repeated that the administration will use the full array of tools to counter China's abusive economic practices. The strategy will include working with allies to take on China's unfair actions. And Yellen said that it's important that aid from the IMF, the World Bank and elsewhere to help countries around the world combat COVID-19 doesn't end up going to repay Chinese loans. More broadly, Yellen said the US needed to compete with China's economic statecraft around the world and build partnerships distinguished from President Xi Jinping's signature Belt and Road Initiative. On debt issuance, Yellen said that she will review the Treasury's debt issuance strategy, including the weighted average maturity of federal debt. She didn't immediately suggest major changes. Today, the demand for existing Treasury instruments remains robust and is sufficient to meet US financing needs. Introducing new ultra-long-term instruments would add new complexities to this market and deserves further study. Turning to climate change, she said, we cannot solve the climate crisis. Without effective carbon pricing. The president supports an enforcement mechanism that requires polluters to bear the full cost of the carbon pollution they are emitting. She also said tax policy should be used to provide incentives for individual businesses to adopt climate-friendly policies. But she raised concerns about proposals to impose stress tests on banks to measure their ability to withstand the economic impact of climate change on assets and loans. Generating environmental regulation is not the mission of financial regulators. Such tests are an indirect punishment for holding fossil fuel assets, she said. And Yellen warned that stranded assets could result from the development of new forms of clean energy. With regard to foreign sanctions, Yellen said the Treasury would conduct a careful review of sanctions to ensure that they're targeted, effective, and minimize unintended consequences. The Trump administration imposed a wide range of sanctions on companies, individuals, and even oil tankers tied to Iran, North Korea, China, Venezuela, and Russia, often unilaterally. I commit to rigorously enforcing sanctions targeting Russian actors for territorial aggression in eastern Ukraine and Crimea and other threats to U.S. national security, she said. So far as the Iran deal is concerned, Yellen said that she would ensure Iran takes steps to resume compliance with the nuclear deal struck under the Obama administration, which will be needed to warrant sanctions relief. And she also said she agreed that Iran is the world's largest sponsor of state terrorism, and I will ensure that Treasury continues its important work to combat Iran's support for terrorism and the abuse of human rights. Now, back here in Australia, auction fever is hitting early as sellers and buyers catch up, according to the Financial Review. A rush of auctions is stirring the Sydney and Melbourne markets into auctions much earlier than usual this year, as home sellers, buoyed by the strong appetite shown by buyers before Christmas, throw open their doors to summertime bidders. This week, 174 auctions were listed for Melbourne, which is more than four times the count for the comparable week last year, according to SQM Research. The following week, the count rises rapidly to 439, more than double the corresponding period last year. And it's a similar, albeit a more muted pattern in Sydney, with 53 auctions set for this week, a substantial step up from a year earlier. The count rises to 278 the following week, double what it was last year. This is a very strong showing by vendors, SQM Research's Louis Christopher said. The momentum will carry on into February after an unseasonably large wave of fresh listings in the last weeks of the year. Prime the auction pipeline. New listings for homes for sale through December jumped almost 14% in Sydney year on year and by more than 30% in Melbourne. After a big run right up to the final weekend before Christmas, the market barely paused over the break, with the action underway again well ahead of the traditional start following the Australia Day long weekend. Driving the high level of activity are sellers and buyers catching up on lost time. Combined with that is a strong dose of confidence provided by recovering prices, ultra-low borrowing costs, and just this week news that the unemployment rate is falling more quickly than expected. there would be a lot of agents who have reached out to their contacts and sellers saying, I've got a lot of interest right now, Mr. Christopher said. Now is the time to do it because the buyers are out there. And if you are still looking to sell, now is the time to roll. Buyers are already being encouraged by the steady drumbeat of positive market data and forecasts. Clearance rates across the combined capital cities hit 69.4% over the December quarter, the best quarterly result for the year. According to CoreLogica, of course, we should add, on very low volumes. Auction volumes, though, jumped 44.1% over the 3 months to December, with 20,489 homes taken to auction across the capital cities, up from 14,216 over the September quarter. Much of that boost came as Melbourne exited its lengthy second lockdown. Sentiment for homes also hit a two-year high in December, with 79,187 transactions finalised, a 22% lift on the previous year. And the rush went all the way to Christmas Eve, when 1,711 settlements were completed, according to data from online property settlement platform Pexa. We saw property settlement numbers beginning to recover following the easing of restrictions nationally in the second half of the year. However, the rebound in Victoria was delayed due to the second lockdown, said Senior Research Manager Mike Gill. Sydney home values weathered the disruption to gain 2.7% over the last year. Melbourne prices suffered a modest 1.3% fall despite the extended lockdowns. Of course, those averages are completely meaningless. Units are dropping, houses not. Economists are taking a bullish view on prices this year, including at UBS, which this week forecast a rise of 5% or to 10%, with the risk of 10% plus, particularly given the planned repeal of responsible lending. The Melbourne Institute Index of House Price Expectations climbed a further 1.1% on January, after its 9.4% jump in December. And Westpac's chief economist Bill Evans is expecting a 15% national price, quote, surge by 2023, which translates to a rise of about 7.5% a year. And that tallies with the UBS economist George Thalenu, who is expecting house prices to rise by 5 to 10% year on year. He adds, there is now a risk that house prices could rise by more than 10%, particularly given the planned repeal of responsible lending. So should Reserve Bank boss Philip Lowe be getting ready to stage an intervention to thwart the imminent surge in house prices? Well, of course, Dr. Lowe would have had a close look at the Reserve Bank's own confidential research that argues that house values could jump 30% over 3 years if near zero interest rates persisted. The central bank's cash rate, of course, stood at 0.75% in late 2019. Before the virus hit, it now stands at 0.1%. According to an internal Reserve Bank report released last November, a permanent 1 percentage point cut in the cash rate would increase real house prices by 30% over 3 years. The combination of a high jobless rate and extremely weak wages growth will act as a brake on rising house prices. But house prices would rise by only 10% over 3 years if the reduction in interest rates was temporary. This finding is unlikely, they say, to have astonished Dr. Lowe. Appearing before a federal parliamentary committee in Canberra last December, he noted that there's been divergent trends in the housing market over the past 9 months, with many regional markets doing better than the capital city markets and a divergence between house prices and apartment prices. But he noted, it does appear that the trend is towards house prices at the moment, and that shouldn't surprise us. Low interest rates do mean higher prices. It's part of the transmission mechanism. Now, there are two main ways that lower interest rates rev up activity in the housing market, which in turn leads to higher jobs growth and economic activity. In the first instance, people take advantage of lower home borrowing costs to either build new houses or renovate their existing dwellings. This is evident in the building activity figures released earlier this week. In the September quarter of 2020, private house commencements rose 4% and stood 7.3% above the level a year earlier. The urge to renovate is also kicking in, with spending on alterations and additions rebounding sharply in the quarter. But unit commitments slumped 7.5% in the quarter to their lowest level since 2012. This meant the overall number of dwelling units commenced fell 0.8% in the 3 months to September, although it was still 3.5% above its level a year earlier. This is telling evidence that ultra-low interest rates have been highly effective in boosting activity in the housing construction industry, even in the midst of a pandemic. And this boost to housing construction has been all the more important given the slide in the value of non-residential building commencements, particularly for offices and short-term accommodation and hotels. And of course, rising house prices also have an important psychological effect. This means people feel more confident about their financial situation, which in turn makes them more inclined to open their wallets. So the question that Dr. Lowe is considering is whether we're getting close to the point where people are so confident their house prices are poised for recovery that they start taking on too much risk. It's possible that prospective home buyers could become so anxious about looming house price rises they decide to load themselves up with debt, which then drives house prices even higher. Alternatively, they could decide to overstretch themselves financially on the grounds they'll be rescued by a rising market. Still, the lingering uncertainty over the economic outlook will continue to make prospective home buyers nervous about taking on too much debt. And the combination of a high jobless rate, although the unemployment rate dropped to 6.6% in December, it's still significantly above the pre-pandemic levels, and extremely weak wages growth will act as a brake on rising house prices. The other dampener on house prices will be extremely low population growth, as Dr. Lowe said last December. So we'll see pockets that are very strong, but across the country as a whole, with population growth so low, I'm not expecting to see big increases in housing prices. But Dr. Lowe has clearly signaled he's keeping a close watch on the behaviour of the housing market, looking for signs that home loaners and borrowers are eschewing caution and happily taking on more risk. The country's big four banks freely admit that there's intense competition between them to attract high-quality owner-occupied borrowers, particularly since home lending is the only part of their loan book that is growing. It's also worth noting that some investors are now dipping their toes back into the property market, although lending for investment properties is still fairly flat. Not only are the banks offering tantalizingly low mortgage rates, particularly for fixed rate loans, they're also working hard to slash their turnaround times. And lenders have discovered that mortgage brokers are now quick to move their business away from lenders whose approval times are too long. At least they say so far, there's no indication that banks are relaxing their credit standards in an effort to boost their share of the lucrative mortgage market. It's likely that bankers still have too vivid a memory of the humiliation they suffered at the hands of the Hayne Royal Commission, which put some of their past lending mistakes on bruising public display to drop their credit standards too far. Now, to underscore the competition in the banking sector, two of Australia's big banks, Commonwealth Bank and Westpac, have today slashed savings rates, according to Canstar. Commonwealth Bank has cut its savings rates for the third time in less than 3 months, making this the ninth cut from the bank since January 2020. And at the same time, Westpac has cut savings rates twice in less than 3 months and eight times since the start of last year. The blow to savers comes at the same time home loan rates fall, with NAB subsidiary UBank cutting its three-year fixed rate to a new market-leading low of 1.75%. The new rate overtakes the previous low rate of 1.77%, a variable rate on offer from Reduce Home Loans. Canstar's finance expert Steve Mickenbecker says Commonwealth Bank and Westpac have opened the batting in 2021 among the big four banks, with cuts in their savings rates, and you can expect other banks to soon be driving their rates down further. First home buyer savings for deposits will have to do all the heavy lifting themselves, with interest providing only a meager contribution towards the home loan goal. Retirees have reconciled to a succession of saving rate cuts over the past 2 years and have resorted to higher risk investments like shares to fund their living. There are often winners and losers, and savers are enduring a long losing streak. The depth of the cuts is clear, with Commonwealth Bank's net savings rate falling by 1.15% since January 2020. At the same time, Westpac's saver fell by 1.26%, while all the Reserve Bank cash rates fell by just 0.65%. The property market is red hot, he said, and banks don't want to miss out on a once-in-a-generation opportunity to grow their loan books portfolios, which is great news for borrowers. With UBank, the latest to take lenders further down the interest rate ladder, with a special offer of 1.75% fixed for 3 years. The gauntlet has been thrown down again, and this time by a subsidiary of one of the big four banks. It shows how hungry even the behemoths of banking are for new home loan business, and how it must be getting tougher for smaller lenders. Home borrowers can find bargain rates at the moment all the way down to 1.75%, but that's not the case for savers who just have to hunt around for the better rate. The top rate in the market is just 1.75%. And I think that the market is going to get hotter and hotter. I think we're going to see more cuts to saving rates as well as loan rates. And of course, that just underscores the severe competitive pressure in the banking sector. And the likelihood is that the banks will cut their lending standards somewhat to try and maintain their position in the market. Still, if bankers' memories turn out to be somewhat defective, Dr. Lowe has signalled he'll have no qualms about staging a housing market intervention. Last December, he expected that given the cautiousness of the banks and the change in people's attitudes to debt, we're not going to see people rushing to the banks to try to borrow 90 to 95% of their loan. But he added, if they do, then we'll have to have a discussion with the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority, the bank regulator, about whether there should be some control there. And I would just remind everybody again that the government is proposing to remove the responsible lending obligations on lenders by the end of March. And if that's true, then that could indeed turn the spigot open further and drive prices even higher. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.